Boston Public Radio.
Hey, it's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. You know, as Ann Mastu just said on the news, the memorial service for MIT officer Sean Collier is underway. We will bring you live the remarks of Senator Elizabeth Warren and Vice President Joe Biden. That's going to happen. That part, at least, will happen roughly 30 minutes from now. The place, by the way, it is just, as Ann said, thousands and thousands and thousands of people outside. A sea of police officers, just staggering, this sea of blue.
Well, you know what's really neat? They have suspended a huge American flag between two cranes, and it's got to be, how many feet would you say that is in the air?
It looks like 100. I don't 100 know,
feet
but it's
in the
pretty
air.
Impressive.
And then it looks... It's huge, and it's really impressive.
You know, one more thing, Marjorie. We're going to be joined in a second by Bill Keating, a congressperson on the Homeland Security Committee. You know, this morning I go to a convenience store in Cambridge to buy a ticket for Powerball, as I always do for us, $120 million or something tonight. As I'm leaving, and not until I'm leaving, you know what I realize? It's the 7-Eleven on Massachusetts Avenue where Johar Tsarnaev remember the photograph of him buying snacks on the night that Sean Collier was murdered and they're on their way to Watertown? I mean, the surreal nature of this really never, it never ends.
Well, I was wondering for days how that they supported themselves because it seemed, you know, the older brother had a child and so forth. Well, we learned in the Herald this morning that at least until 2012, they were supporting themselves with taxpayer dollars in the form of welfare payments and that they told the carjack victim, the man in the Mercedes, that they planned to go to New York with cars full of bombs.
Yeah, and then the Globe, and Brian McGorry is going to join us in an hour, talks about how they scraped together some additional dough from a variety of sources. There's every day, every hour, new information. Speaking of new information, we're joined on the phone by a congressman from the 9th Congressional District in Massachusetts. He also serves in the Homeland Security and Foreign Affairs Committee. Congressman Bill Keating, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, Congressman. Thanks for being with us. Congressman, as most people know now, Tamerlan, the older brother, spent some time in Russia. You were about to go to Moscow. So what are you trying to find out over there?
Well, actually, it's staff. My staff is going. There'll be one Democrat and one Republican going to Russia. And we're going in part, I think, to complement what's going on in the law enforcement community. And law enforcement, the Russians, as has been, you know, said already publicly, they did communicate to the U.S. government about Tamerlan, their concerns. So we already have the ongoing law enforcement relationship. There's in the Caucasus Mountain region, which is part of what the committee I am ranking member on has as a jurisdiction. That is a breeding ground for terrorist activity. Al Qaeda, other groups are known to be in those remote areas and use it as a training ground and a breeding ground for terrorists. Now, Russia can be cooperative in that respect. Some of the area, Chechnya and other, they've had, you know, just grisly historical, you know, battles with over the centuries. But despite their motivation in getting involved, we think that we can better improve from an international standpoint, communication back and forth. It could be helpful with the U.S. in dealing with these situations in the future.
You know, Bill Keating, there are a couple of issues, and you know about them better than we, but we're just doing it from consuming the news. The FBI says after the initial contact from Russia and an interview with Tamerlan, the older brother, and his friends and family in spring and summer of 2011, there were no contacts. Your colleague, United States Senator Richard Burr from North Carolina, says in an intelligence briefing he was told there were subsequent contacts. That's one. Two, this trip back to Russia that everybody's been talking about by the older brother for 6 months, the FBI said because of a misspelling of the name, they didn't know anything about it. Homeland's security head, Napolitano, says that, of course, we knew about it. So is that part of what the mission of your committee is, to get to the bottom of who knows what here and who's telling the truth?
Well, that'll be part of the Homeland Security Committee's hearings that will be coming. The chair has already announced that he will conduct those hearings. So that in that committee, that's where that kind of information will be analyzed. From the Committee on Foreign Affairs, we were more concerned about trying to establish a better international network of sharing information about just what's happening in that region. If they have information going forward, that's fine. Not necessarily information specific to individuals. That would come more from the Homeland Security and the FBI standpoint.
But isn't that a concern of yours, Bill Kaden? I mean, if it turns out maybe everybody's telling the truth, maybe one branch of government, Homeland Security, knew about this trip to Russia, but the FBI is also telling the truth, and they didn't know about the trip to Russia. If they're both being honest, isn't it a concern about nobody's talking to each other?
Well, when we have the interviews like we're having right now, I always have to preface things by talking about published reports or reports that are already out there, because as part of this job, we sign, an oath and an agreement not to divulge things that are told in our briefing.
We understand.
I think it is out there that the FBI did follow through and do the job that they have and the protocols that they do have. One thing that will come out of this undoubtedly is great scrutiny on by themselves as well as others on exactly what those protocols are, what they use for different means of screening out or taking up information to another level, what algorithms they might use, what kind of advice. It becomes very technical. All that being said, they will look at that and see if those things have to be altered, if there's a way to do it better. What we've been reassured of, and it's been in the press, is that they did their job as their job was laid out for them. What we learn from these events is, can we do that job better? Do we have to make changes? And I think all that's going to be done at every single level. This is a case where, just like a forensic case that I was involved with when I was a district attorney, just because they capture the person, the investigations still continue at a frenetic pace on many other levels, less obviously, though. So they're looking at every other level. They are going to go over, I believe, and the FBI and talk to Russian officials. They're going to go through all the computer records with their technical people. They're going to go through every associate that they can find. This will be extremely thorough and well scrubbed. And I think that as part of that, and that's what we'll do with the things that can be said publicly, we'll be looking at how we can make changes and do things differently. But as we've been reassured that they did their assignments. They did what they are supposed to do. But that doesn't mean that we can't look in the future and say, should we do something different?
We're talking with Congressman Bill Keating, and you used the word reassured a couple of times. I am just the opposite. My feeling is that there was a man that was on the radar of the Russian government. The FBI looked at him. There's disputes here about how many times they looked at him. But he was having outbursts in his local mosque to the point that they had to ask him to leave and seemed to be rather unsteady emotionally. It's scary, I think, to the average citizens, particularly people, that live near these two characters, or the entire city of Boston has gone through this, Congressman. I don't feel reassured at all. I feel as though it's 10 years after 9/11, and forget the communication between the Russians and us. The communication within our own government is not happening the way it should.
At the 10th anniversary of 9/11, there was a whole reassessment of where we are, what we've done. We are light years ahead. So you take this as strongly as I can tell you. We are light years ahead of where we were before 9/11 in coordination and in dealing with it. And in fact, that Joint Terrorism Task Force is one of the best in the country at coordination. Now, that is it perfect? No. I mean, you're not going to get perfect. Perfect can be the enemy of the good in so many instances. But it's a fine institution. We're light years ahead. What's happened since 9/11, and we said that as a result of our hearings, although we're acting more professionally and we're acting in a coordinated way, we have much greater resources, the threats are greater. And the number one threat that we heard time and time again at these hearings was of these either lone wolves or small groups of domestic or homegrown terrorists.
Well, that
was presented as the greatest threat because it's the hardest to detect. They are here in the United States.
Right.
They're radicalized here, either being born here or lived here for a number of years, and they become radicalized. They know how to assimilate into a crowd the way that these two people did. They know the roots. They don't have to worry about getting into the country. They're already here. They know how to access explosive equipment. So we were told time and time again that this very type of act presented the greatest national threat to us because it's the hardest to deal with.
But one of the reports is in the papers today, Congressman Bill Keating, and maybe it's incorrect, is that one of the reasons that Tamerlan escaped the scrutiny that he should have received was because there was the links between him and al-Qaeda were dismissed, and there wasn't enough looking at the Chechenian influence.
Because they were not seen as a threat to the United States and its people.
Well, you know, one of the things with they did everything they were told once they got that information. I think it's been publicly told as well that they asked, they followed up and asked for more information from the Russians and didn't receive it as well. Now, they're going to be looking at all those issues more carefully going forward as they look at everything that happens here. Now, we're going to know in more specifics than yesterday because the investigation is ongoing now. I mean, if there's one thing that came from yesterday's briefing, it's that the investigation is going forward at all levels. And so it's an inchoate state, and we'll have more specific information in the future. Those things that can be aired publicly will be as part of a hearing going forward when we scrutinize everything that was done, because I do think the public should know this information. They should know it in as much detail as can be disclosed, you know, without compromising our security. But right now they're in the middle of an investigation, and they don't have all that information on hand to evaluate.
Bill Keating, by the way, Bill Keating is a congressman from the 9th CD in Massachusetts, serves on the Homeland Security and Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Representatives. Are these, first of all, when are these hearings going to happen? And two, I think I read you say somewhere that some of them might happen in Boston. Is that correct?
Well, I think one thing that I discussed with the chair, maybe not a whole hearing, but certainly going back to where we were, where we had our other hearings, when they're ready and settle down. They're not in the midst of investigation. Mm-hmm. To go down and review how they actually implemented everything that occurred. We did that. We could do that not only to see what problems were encountered, but also for best practices going forward. I think one thing that was clear, the law enforcement performed extremely well in a crisis and is really to be lauded for it, but also to put together some of the information they gathered that could make their job better and not. I mean, we went through that at the hearing over a year ago, right at Logan Airport, right at the Fusion Center there, so that, and we came away understanding the need for this. I put amendments in that were passed, actually, in this Congress to speed along more of those type of centers that we have in Boston throughout the country, so that we also have to look. I know no one wants to talk about this right now, but because it pales in comparison to the human loss and the tragedies, the personal tragedies that surround this. But, you know, we're also part of our job will be funding. What things are we going to fund going forward? Are we keeping track technologically? Are we in our public transit system? Do we have the kind of cameras, security cameras that some other, you know, a lot of other countries have? We're falling behind in some areas in terms of technology. We're ahead in others. And I think there's going to be that whole kind of review, particularly at Homeland on this. On the foreign affairs side, I'm looking for perhaps better relations so that we can information share at all levels, not just the law enforcement level in the future with countries like Russia.
A couple of more questions, Bill Keating. Thank you so much for your time. I want to get back to what you said about these homegrown terrorists being the scariest and what happened last Monday being the first of its kind in the United States. Everybody did fear. Have you been briefed in any of your capacities on the interrogation of the younger brother? We've been reading in the paper that he's said to interrogators, I've acted alone. He confessed that they did it. We have heard from others that they were potentially on their way to New York City. Have you been briefed in on
Iraq and Afghanistan
that upset them,
the
right? And the death of innocent Muslims. According to them. Have you been briefed on any of that, and can you tell us whether you can confirm any of that?
Well, you know, the vast majority of the purpose for that is going forward is the prosecution, which we're not going to be briefed on and shouldn't be briefed on in terms of the way that you don't want to interfere with the prosecution and investigation. The other, if there are major issues that he came forward with of enlarged cells or something, that's the type of thing we would have been briefed on. And we were not briefed on that.
Okay, last set of things from me. I want to get back to what you said a minute ago, Bill Keating. This is what, even for those of us who are lay people, we heard for years, it's these homegrown types with the kinds of with bombs that could be built at home for very short money. Going forward, do you have confidence, despite the competence of the police after the fact here, that the United States government and local officials have the capacity to stop the next brothers, I don't mean that literally, but you know what I mean, who are hell-bent on doing the exact same thing somewhere else, unless we essentially go into lockdown or insane levels of security?
They will continue to represent a great risk to us. And in fact, one thing you said before, this wasn't the first time. There was the Times Square's bombing.
No, I'm talking about the kind of thing where you have a backpack, where you literally, you know, I'm not talking about driving a fertilizer truck to the Mara building.
I don't think you can stop it, frankly.
No, but I want to be clear here, Congressman, if I may. This, in that one regard, the kind of bomb you can literally carry in a backpack,
right,
that was the kind of thing that I've been reading about for years. And this is, at least to my knowledge, the first time something like that is happening on so small a scale with such broad implications.
It's the first time it's gone as far as it did.
Right.
And we're going to live with those risks. In answer to your question as directly as I can, yes, we will continue to live with those risks. We're going to try and minimize those risks, and we're going to try and improve the response at every level. And that means digging into the issues of how people become radicalized, what's going on, are there earlier signals to deal with that? So it's dealing with preventative issues as well as trying to uncover what's going on. And as I said, the reason they were the number one risk after 9/11 by all the experts and all the officials was the fact that they can operate in plain sight, so to speak. They can be the person, you know, that's down the street. They could have been the college student in the dorm near them.
And they were.
And the one thing we have to remember is that we cannot get lax in terms of the first responders as well. When we went to other parts of the country with our hearing, we were told, and when we asked, what more can we do? One of the first things that they said is, make sure that the first responders, the people that are in the community, that are policing and doing investigations in the community, make sure that they are funded. Because if you are going to thwart some of these things, they will be the people on the front line that will be able to deal with it. So coming full circle, one of the things we have to do is don't forget to get back down to basics. Don't forget how important it was to have those local police officers like perform the way they did in Watertown. Don't forget how important it is to have that instant communication of what's going on in that neighborhood and how to respond with that. Or have people in that community that someone that might see something that would strike a person's suspicion would feel comfortable going forward with. So a lot of this will get very technical. A lot of it will get sophisticated with equipment and technology. But the one thing I've learned, too, in the last couple of years of hearing was don't forget the importance of the frontline law enforcement response and their ability to prevent something from happening. And we really saw in Boston this past week how well they can perform and how important their function is.
Let's hope your 434 colleagues get that as well as you do. Congressman Bill Keating, Homeland Security and Foreign Affairs Committee, we really appreciate your time. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much. Okay, up next, we are taking a survey. I should say, by the way, Congressman Keating does sit on the House Homeland Security and Foreign Affairs Committee, where he is the ranking member of the Europe, Eurasia, and Emerging Threats Subcommittee. So he obviously knows what he's talking about in regard to this, all this foreign terrorism and domestic terrorism. Up next, we're taking a survey. What are some of the big and small unanswered questions about the Marathon bombings that you'd like answers to? That's next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
When news happens, it happens to all of us. You live here, you work here, and we do too. So when news happens, we're here to keep you connected to information and to each other. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Simmons, presenting their new healthcare MBA program, now enrolling for fall 2013, an accredited, established MBA program with 67% of its content healthcare focused and designed by current leaders in the healthcare industry, simmons.edu. And the Zeiterion Theater, proudly presenting Oscar-winning actress Olympia Dukakis in a tour de force performance of Rose, Saturday, April 27th. Tickets and more information available at Zeiterion.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. In 20, 25 minutes, we will take you live to Cambridge, where the memorial service for Sean Collier is happening. I've never seen something like this before. Actually, the casket of Sean Collier was carried into the memorial service at its beginning just a couple of minutes ago. We will go there live to hear Elizabeth Warren and Vice President Joe Biden again in 20 or 30 minutes. What we want to spend this time with is asking you what we ask ourselves. What are the remaining unanswered questions about what happened last Monday and before and since that are consuming you? I mean, we woke up this morning, Marta, you mentioned this at the top of the show, to begin to get answers in the Herald and the Globe on something that many of our callers have asked about. Where did their money come from? The Herald story talked about them being on welfare until a year ago. Mm-hmm. The Globe story filled in some other blanks about how they picked up odd money here and there, fixing cars, sort of thing.
And selling pot in the case
exactly.
of the younger suspect.
But we want to know, obviously everybody wants to know the why. And we've begun to get the sense from the interrogation of Jahar that, as Marjorie said a couple of minutes ago, it was about the impact on Muslims, according to these two brothers, of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Who knows if that's true or not? But beyond the why, what are the questions that are you just, some are small. For example, one of the questions asked at a terrific press conference with three of the first responders, actually the three first responders out of four at 67 Franklin Street, three Boston cops, Superintendent Evans was asked the question that goes back and forth, was the boat in the perimeter? I believe Colonel Albin told us last Saturday it was not in the perimeter. Then last night we heard it was
back
in the perimeter.
In the perimeter.
And it raises the question, if it was in the perimeter, was it searched? That's a small issue. A large issue.
It's a big issue because a boat is a great hiding place, isn't it? I mean, you could be hiding in the boat without being in anyone's house.
No,
and
I understand
having to
kidnap
anyone.
But there's some large issues, too. One of the things that I can't stop thinking about is were these three murders in Waltham a couple of years ago.
Yep.
One of them, you know, Brendan Mess and two of his friends. Brendan Mess was allegedly the older brother's close friend. Were these two brothers responsible for those unsolved crimes? So we want to know at 877-301-8970, while we wait for Senator Warren and Vice President Biden to take to the podium, what are the questions that are literally consuming you? And I have to say, consume is the word that's operative for me. There's some of these things that I literally cannot stop thinking about. When I woke up to read about their personal finances in both papers this morning, there was some level of, I don't even know what the word
defense,
is.
In defense, I think the Globe got it from the Herald, Jim.
No, it was the Herald story. No, the Globe story was 99% not about the welfare thing.
Right.
The Herald story was all about the welfare payments, and the Globe story was about all other income. By the way, crediting the Herald for the welfare piece.
The Herald credit where credit is due. And also the older brother got a public defender when he was arrested for allegedly hitting his girlfriend back in 2009.
That was the Herald this morning, yeah.
Yes, we have an email from Brenda who's asking about the story about the man who got away after his Mercedes was carjacked. Why haven't we told anything about him? We still don't know the identity of that man, and I would imagine he's a little bit nervous right now. He probably does not want to be hounded by every media outlet in America, and he could also be worried about his situation because he's going to be a big witness. But we should.
Well, let's stay on that for a second. I don't think it's his worry. It may be. In light of the fact that the authorities have made it very clear, usually unnamed sources, that if the statements that Jahar has made pre-getting his Miranda warnings are struck by a court, the key testimony, in addition to the objective evidence, the key testimony is that, guys, I'm assuming the authorities have said, please talk to nobody, give no interviews until you're under oath in a courtroom.
Well, that could be, but we do know something about, so far, what the alleged bombers said to the owner of the Mercedes was
chilling.
That they were going to New York City to continue on their rampage, and that's pretty scary stuff. The carjack victim says one of the brothers or both of the brothers pointed guns at him and said, we're the Boston Bombers. Yeah. In an attempt to intimidate him, they forced him to turn over his ATM card and his password. They took money out of his account. It has been reported it was $800 going to several different ATMs, but that's sort of fallen on by the way, so I haven't seen nothing about that in the last couple of days. But the fact that they planned to go to New York is pretty scary.
877-301-8970. Again, what are your questions? And by the way, we're going to keep a record of all these things, and we're going to do our best to get answers. And as answers appear in local and national media, we will bring them to you. Let's start in Malden, where Sue is on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Pleasure.
One of the first questions I had when I was hearing about the discovery of the blood in the van after the shootout in Watertown was, why didn't they have bloodhounds to follow that blood trail?
You know, Sue, so we had the Colonel, is it Albin?
Albin, yes, Albin, Superintendent of the State Cops.
Yes, on the radio a couple of days ago, and he was talking about there being different kinds of dogs. There are bomb-sniffing dogs. There are drug-sniffing dogs.
That was your first question.
Yes,
you were pretty obsessed
and,
with that, too.
And that there was not a dog there. I don't know. Bloodhounds obviously are tracking blood, but there apparently was no bloodhound on duty, or he didn't mention anything about having any bloodhounds there to track the second suspect. That the dogs they had there, because there were dogs, were not blood tracking dogs.
But Sue, we will be like bloodhounds. We will be on the case, and as soon as we get an answer to that, you'll hear it here between noon and two. Thanks, Sue, so much
for
your question.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You know what I love about Sue's question?
What?
Is that shows the way that the average person in this part of the country is drilling down on the most, you know, focused, I don't mean small, insignificant, but small detail of this investigation. From the large questions to the small questions, this is all people are thinking
but
about.
But it is a great question.
It is a great question.
Why did it take 20 hours? You had the superintendent also did say that the younger brother was likely wounded in the car in the shootout. So why?
Albin told us that, yeah.
Yes, now he fled in the Mercedes. So you don't know. I mean, was there blood of his on the street or was he in the car the whole time? We don't know.
And if it was in the perimeter, the superintendent from the Boston Police, Evans, was asked last night, was it in the perimeter? He said yes, which contradicts some of the earlier, obviously, assertions. And was it searched before if it was in the perimeter? And I believe his answer was he didn't think so.
And
the question is, why wasn't it searched since a boat with a tarp is such an obvious hiding place? And by the way, I'm not criticizing the police. These are just, I think, totally legitimate questions.
You know what I believe we still don't know? And correct me if I'm wrong. I think I've read everything there is about
this case.
But I don't think we know yet how the older brother died. He was shot multiple times by police. He ran out of ammunition, at which point the police tackled him and were handcuffing him. And then the younger brother ran him over, according to police, in the Mercedes. Now, was the running over by his younger brother what killed him?
Because, yeah, that's
a great
question. I believe
we still do not have the medical examiner's report on that. Let's go to Carol in New Hampshire. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you? Thanks.
Great.
One question I have had as I watched all this take place was, you saw all of the interviews with people, students, especially the second bomber, who claim they recognize the bomber from class or from whatever else, but none of them that I saw had any intention of calling the FBI. Did anybody, once those photos were released, did the FBI get tips identifying them?
Well, I know at least one person I interviewed who had gone to get her facials at the Norfolk Street apartment where the family lived. She called the FBI
immediately after seeing
the photos because she recognized Jahar, the younger brother, because he was often in the house where she was getting the facials. And she recognized the older brother as well. So she did, a Belmont mother.
But wait a second. So if that's the answer to the question, Carol's question, then did they immediately not go to, what is it, 410? Is it 410 or 412 Norfolk? Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Did they go to the Norfolk Street apartment to see if the people who were identified were there? Apparently they did not. Is that not correct?
I don't know.
Well, it all happened pretty fast after that. But it just struck me how many people had no intention of calling, even though they recognized them.
Well, by the way, when you said it happened pretty fast, it was roughly 5 hours from the moment that Rick DeLaurier, who is the FBI agent in charge here, released those photographs, and the time that the Officer Collier was allegedly executed by these two people, which is not that little amount of time. But Carol, thanks for the great question.
And I should also say, I was speaking with the FBI the other day about this call from this mother and trying to confirm that call from the mother. And the spokesperson that I was talking with said that they had received hundreds, if not thousands, of calls. So they got a lot of calls. The specifics of all the calls and where they came from and what time they came from, she wasn't telling me, but they did get a lot of calls. Let's go to John from Gardner. Hi, John.
Hi, folks. How are you?
Hi there.
Hey, mine is kind
of... Oh, John, how are you? Good to talk to you again, John.
I'm well. You good. Guys are too, right?
Yeah, we're really good. Thanks, sir, for calling. Go ahead, John.
You're welcome. Mine's kind of more broad, and I don't think any of us could answer it right now, but and maybe just enterprising journalists could or whatnot, because I don't think the authorities... But these hardcore Islamist, radical Islamist websites and so forth, I mean, how many people are just accessing them? And then of that number, how many is just curiosity and how many are just, I mean, are really, you know, in the process of getting radicalized? And that's to my way of thinking, that's to your point, Marjorie. I don't think we can stop this type of an attack. And how the hell can they, with the numbers that I'm guessing are involved, how can they track down each and every possible lead? You know what I mean?
Well, I don't mean to be depressing about this, but I think you're right, John. I mean, you
well,
wonder.
Well, Congressman Keating agreed.
Yeah, you wonder whether this is going to be the way we're going to live our lives now. You're just looking over your shoulder in bus stations and train stations and airports. We're already looking over our shoulder there. And, you know, in any group's large gatherings. We had an email the other day that talked about how when London put all these cameras
right.
everywhere so that Londoners are photographed multiple times a day. I think it's 300 times a day. It's not that the
three
average.
300 to 400, yeah.
Yeah. That the crime started to move out to the countryside because
that
of that.
Email.
So
yeah.
You wonder whether if our security becomes really heightened in urban areas, then these things start happening in the country.
No.
It's scary.
As a follow-up to that, the London bombings, I read where they, you know, those folks were, would it be second generation? Their parents had immigrated. They were born in England. And they radicalized after. So my point with that is, if they had no travel to any other foreign countries or whatnot, like I'm sure there's people here that were born here, and they have no travel stuff to get a hook on them, I mean, how many of those folks are getting radicalized as second and third generation? Because we see that in other immigrant populations where the second and third generation, whether it's the old days getting the mafia going or what have you, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure they were born in England. That's not my information.
I'm sorry?
I'm not sure they were born in England, John. We'll have to double check that. I think that one of them was born in a section of Russia. I think both of them were.
Both of them were, I think. John,
no,
thank
no,
you.
In the London bombing.
Oh, the London
bombing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
John, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We got to go. There are a bunch of questions adding to our list on Boston Public Radio's Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Boston Public Radio. Dan Kennedy, as in media watcher Dan Kennedy from Northeastern, he raises an interesting question. I think we should pick up on with Brian McGorry when he calls. I'd still like to know why so many news organizations reported last Wednesday that suspects were in custody and why they were so reluctant to back down. Were government officials deliberately misleading the media? No, it's interesting. These are not the media that which did report that are not the slimy kind of media types. Associated Press, CNN, Boston Globe. We should ask them, is it possible, in light of the fact they all thought they had reliable sources, that they were being misled? Margie writes, how about Catherine Russell, meaning the wife? What did she know? Their lawyer, by the way. We can answer that one. We don't know if it's true. Catherine Russell, the wife of Tamerlan, has said, the lawyer says she knew nothing. And Aaron Reed asks a question. We're going to ask Treasurer Steve Grossman later. What's the total cost, at least a credible estimate, of the lockdown, both hard costs for police and first responders and the cost in lost business and wages?
You know, Catherine Russell, think about her life. She has a little baby. She marries this guy, Tamerlan. He's home taking care of the baby. She's working 70 and 80 hours a week as a home health aide for $12.50 an hour. Claims she knew absolutely nothing about it. You wonder again, your husband's home building bombs. I mean, aren't you?
And collecting public assistance, according to the Herald, through much of that until last year.
Yes, so it was a cramped apartment. So who knows? But that's what she claims. And maybe it's possible. I don't know. Let's go to Chris in the car. Hi, Chris in the car.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
Excellent. Hey. Thanks, Chris.
Real quick, when the FBI stepped to the podium at 5 o'clock and released those pictures, are you telling me that they'd interviewed this guy a few years before, he was not a threat, he'd subsequently been arrested on a domestic assault, so somebody had a picture of him, and that they still didn't know, or did they know, and then release that information to try and flush him out? I mean, that's kind of been in my craw for a while.
By the way, I think you have the chronology backwards. I believe the domestic violence was, and it was a 2009
margin. 2009 was domestic violence.
But still, your point is a wonderful point. We've asked that question, too. If they interviewed him and his family, the assumption is they had his picture. in their some sort of database, and why didn't they match that picture to the photographs they released on Thursday night? Great question, Chris, and it's added to our list.
You know, we have a question. We have a question on our email address, which is bpr@wgbh.org. We know that the younger brother was back at UMass Dartmouth going to the gym and going to classes and acting like a normal student after the bombings, which is just incredible in and of itself. What was the older brother doing? All I know is that the wife, although she claims she knew nothing, claims that they were living together in the house through Thursday, and that was the day that the photographs...
On Norfolk Street, you're talking
right,
about, in Cambridge.
So we don't know what he was doing. We presume he was home taking care of the three-year-old kid, a little girl, by the way.
You know what's also amazing? I don't know if I've said this on the air. I know I've said this to you off the air. We spoke to someone last week before this all came out. Well, as soon as the identity of these people happened, maybe it must have been Friday. And so remember the guy who called us and said, I was at the gym yesterday at UMass, and one of the people at the gym told me that Zahar had swiped his card on Tuesday or Wednesday? We're both looking at each other like, let's be polite, because we don't know if this is... But what is the likelihood of him returning to the UMass campus? And it appears that that caller knew exactly what he was talking about. 877-301-8970 or BPR at WGBH.org. By the way, in between guests today and in a couple of minutes, we're going to go to Elizabeth Warren and to Vice President Biden at this memorial for Sean Collier. We'll go live in Cambridge at MIT. In between guests today, we're going to continue to take calls, amassing whatever questions you have, and we're going to do our best to put together a comprehensive list and try to get them answered.
Let's go to Tammy in Boston. Hi, Tammy.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it. Yep.
I have lots of questions, like everybody, but my purpose of the call now is more or less a comment. I've been watching and on the news and listening to your show and every day since the incident occurred. And while all the law enforcement are getting the praise that they do deserve, there is one bunch that I haven't heard anyone mention, and that is the Boston Police Bomb Squad. Now, a friend of mine happens to be on the bomb squad, so I know what type of a week they've had last week, and I just wanted to kind of put that out there. These men are away on training constantly, leaving the state, leaving their families to train for this particular unit that they're a part of, and they were going into restaurants, shutting off burners that were left on when, people, chefs ran out of the restaurants, and really in the thick of it, called out to Watertown, answering calls in Quincy last week. There were bomb threats there. They've gone all over the place because a lot of these other communities don't have bomb squads. So I just really wanted to put that forward.
Well, you did a great job.
Yes, you sure did.
Praising the work that they've done, Tammy. I confess I haven't seen it written about. You're absolutely right. And I'm glad you were able to straighten us out on that because I didn't know they were inside turning off burners.
Is there a family member who may perform that service, Tammy?
I'm sorry.
Do you have a family member? You sound like
a friend.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
And I know when he received his training prior to going on to the bomb squad, he was sent to Alabama for about 2 months away from his family. And his wife is also a friend of mine. She's told me that they're constantly leaving the state for training. And I think I caught glimpses of him on the news, and I haven't spoken with him yet. You know, I don't want to ask him too many questions, but I know that, you know, it was a rough week for them as well. And as I said, you know, all the law enforcement deserves praise, but I just wanted to mention that the bomb squad in particular.
You know, Tammy, if you want to hold on the line, you can give your number to our producers. I could call you back and maybe we can get a story about the bomb squad on the radio or in the newspaper, okay?
Okay. My particular friend, he's, not the pat me on the back type guy, but yeah, I will do that.
Good.
Okay,
stay on hold.
Thanks,
Tammy.
Thank you very much, Tammy.
877-301-8970. We're probably about 10 minutes away from Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden addressing the memorial at MIT, which is in the sunshine with thousands and thousands and thousands of faculty, students, but probably most significantly, many, many, many thousands of police officers from all over the country. Let's go to Raleigh, Massachusetts. Raleigh, I think it is. And Carl's on the phone. Hello, Carl.
Hello, Jim.
Hi.
I just want to make the comment that I'm looking here at a copy of today's New Report Daily News, and they get a big headline: suspect got fireworks in Seabrook. And I haven't heard anything on the radio news about this.
Well, it's true. It's reported all over the place. In fact, they've interviewed both the owner and the actual woman who sold the fireworks to Tamerlan. I think it was in February. And what he said was he wanted the biggest, the most powerful and the loudest, and that's what she gave him. But the guy who owns the place said that even all of the gunpowder accumulated in all the fireworks he bought would not have been enough to accomplish whatever purpose he wanted to use if his intention was to use them in the bombs. But it is what you read is accurate.
Absolutely,
and true,
right.
Yeah.
They called them lock and load kits for $200, they had 24 shells, and they contained colored explosives for fireworks. But as you say, Jim, they weren't powerful enough to do the kind of damage that they inflicted on innocent people
and
on
Carl,
Wilson Street.
I'm sorry, we should be clear. We should be clear that the none of that was illegal. The purchase of that and the sale
exactly.
of that in New Hampshire, with nothing wrong, was done by the company in Seabrook that did the selling. Carl, thanks for the call.
There is more detail. We knew this already, but there's just a little bit more detail on the bombs that did do the terrible damage. That they were, we knew that they were from pressure cookers, ordinary kitchen pressure cookers, but they also contained the nails and the household items. And there was one report on CNN that they were bought at Macy's. I know.
But doesn't that
the home
as I
section
said,
of Macy's? How many times have you been at the home section of Macy's? Isn't the Cambridge Side Gallery? And I don't know if they were in the Cambridge Side Galleria, but there is a Macy's home section right
can
there.
I tell you,
Jim.
I've been there more times than I'd like to admit. But it's sorry, if you didn't hear the top of the show, I was in the 7-Eleven. I mean, this every day.
6 degrees of
I'm
separation.
In the 7-Eleven buying a Powerball ticket or two or three for me and Marjorie today.
Yeah.
We've lost most of the times in the past. $116 million.
Jim, if we do win,
we show up for work tomorrow.
Yeah. I'm somehow suspicious that if we do win, the ticket that wins will not be mine.
Well, maybe it won't. But I will tell you, most of the proceeds would go to the One Boston Fund. I speak for myself and Marjorie, but we would show up for work tomorrow. 877-301-8970. Again, just a few minutes away from bringing you live the comments of United States Senator Warren and Vice President Joe Biden from this very, very impressive service. Marjorie said at the top that one of the things right above the stage, which is huge, is a colossally large American flag, and it's suspended between two cranes. And if you drive through MIT on a normal day, everywhere you turn, there is a crane that looks like it's, well, it is literally reaching the sky. Let's go to Easton. Gary, you are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey there, Gary. Hi, Gary. Oh, sorry, you're gone. Let's go to Dedham. Sean is calling from Dedham. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Excellent.
Hi, thank you.
Now, I thought that the American flag in Cambridge was looked at in a bad way, like, you know, thing of horror. They must be
no more. No, not only was
yeah,
that an inappropriate, and not only was that an inappropriate allegation in normal times, in these times it couldn't be farther from the truth. Sean, take
yeah, okay.
it away, though. Go ahead.
Let me next thing that you can berate me on. Jim, it shows Cambridge. Any reason? Oh, I probably know why. Because it's a sanctuary city, and they can feel relaxed that they can go about their bomb making and not be bothered by anyone.
Okay, Sean, next. One more you got in your arse. I don't mean that's a bad pun. Go ahead. What's the last one? That was the last one. Sean, thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970. I believe Elizabeth Warren is up next. James Taylor sang. He's singing again later.
We have another Weisenheimer emailer.
We do. Go ahead.
It's from Walter in Boston. We mentioned before that Catherine Russell was working 70 to 80 hours
that's
a week
the
while
wife
her
of Tamron,
alleged
right.
bomb-making
yeah.
husband was home. Walter wants to know if Catherine has an older sister who'd be willing to work 70 to 80 hours a week so Walter can stay home.
Yeah. Let me tell you, Tamron had quite a deal there. Let's go to Cambridge where Allison's on the phone. Allison, thanks so much for making the call. We appreciate it.
Hi. Yeah. I'm curious if we know what the prescription was that was found in Jahar's car. I'm just trying to figure out. It seems like his personality, people have described him as a really good kid at the high school and also at the college. And, you know, suddenly he was capable of something so violent. And I'm very curious to know what he was taking.
Where did you see that, Allison? Where did you see that report about the prescription? Because I haven't seen that.
Well, when they describe what was in, and I can't, I've read everything like you, I'm consumed by the story.
Yeah.
So I can't remember where I read it, but there were like a couple of items in his car. There was a receipt from the Ralph Lauren store and a lot of empty water bottles. And then they said a prescription. And I don't know if that means that there was an empty bottle or a bottle with pills in it, or maybe even just a piece of paper that had a prescription written on it.
Wow, you have more information than I do, Allison, about that. I'll have to look that up. I've not seen that, Allison. But
Well, I hadn't seen it either. But is it clear,
yeah.
Allison, from your reading as to whether or not it was Jahar's or
it's
was
not.
Potentially the guy who owned the vehicle, the Mercedes, that was carjacked?
Well, it's not from the carjacked car. It's from Jahar's car.
Oh, the second car.
The
okay.
Honda.
Yeah, the one that was down that he had put in the shop.
Understood.
The one, you know what I mean?
We do. It's on our list. We promise we'll do our best to get you answers. Thanks so much, Allison, for the call. 877-301-8970. It's the... we're just minutes away. I'm just checking as we speak from live. We'll go live to Cambridge for this MIT
Memorial. We have a question
yeah. What is it?
About the MBTA officer who was injured, the update on the condition. I believe he's still in serious condition.
Last I heard, which was yesterday, it's Richard Donahue Jr. You know, one of the interesting factoids we heard last night, which I was not aware of before. I don't know if you were. This Superintendent Evans of the Boston Police Department, along with two of his Boston colleagues and a Watertown detective, were the first four people at 67 Franklin Street, obviously on Friday night. You know, it was a really, I thought, a poignant moment, which you may or may not have known. He said when they finally were about to take Jahar into custody, they allowed the MBT officer who was amongst them to put the handcuffs on him in tribute to his colleague, Richard Donahue Jr., who had been shot, which actually is sort of beautiful in some ways. I mean, sort of this relationship cop to cop. And it was, I thought, quite moving, actually. 877-301-8970. We're accumulating questions you have, many of which we have as well. I mean, little by little, as we said, their personal financing, we learned a lot about today in the newspaper. A lot of people upset with the fact that there was a lot of public assistance, according to the Herald, going into the household on every level. And then the Globe filled in a number of blanks, but other income that they were grabbing. You know, I have a feeling just may be seconds away. So, say what you're going to say.
I am big on transparency, and particularly from the government. And it was really horrible that the Herald had to call the state over and over and over again. And it wasn't till politicians got involved in the mix that state officials would release information about whether or not
benefits.
The family was on welfare. That's
By the way, and to credit your own paper, the only reason politicians got involved is because the Herald reporters were calling the state legislature to say, why can't we get this release? What is it called? The Department of Transitional Assistance or whatever it's called?
And also, the younger brother was down at the University of Massachusetts, which is a public school, they should release the information about a scholarship.
Okay, we're going to go live to MIT campus where Elizabeth Warren is addressing the Sean Collier Memorial.
To relieve the weight of your sorrow, there are no actions that can replace what you have lost. Scripture tells us, I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. Last week, here in our community, trouble came. Trouble came to Copley on Monday when terror rocked a day of celebration. Trouble came to Boston on Tuesday and Wednesday as cowards hid from justice. And then on Thursday, trouble came here to Cambridge. Today we remember Officer Sean Collier. Today we grieve together. We hurt together. We pray together. Sean was a model for how a police officer should serve. He knew that a strong, secure community requires more of its police than just to stand guard. It requires them to be full members of the community. He knew almost instinctively that trust, cooperation, friendship, and generosity are the hallmarks not only of community, but of true strength. This spirit marked his service. He was a young man who was inspired to help. He saw his police work as a calling. A young man who was so friendly that he was known across this campus. A young man whose dedication was so great that after visiting dance groups, even as his brother says, with two left feet, he decided to learn how to swing dance so he could better connect with the students whose safety was his responsibility. That was Sean. Sean's life was infused with the spirit of service, that protection, that strength could come only from giving himself fully. It is that same spirit we saw in the firefighters, the police officers, EMS, and guard coordinating the first response and turning peril into protection. It is that same spirit we saw in our world-class hospitals, doctors and nurses and support staff who worked through the day, then worked through the night, then worked through the day again, and who made the difference between life and death. It is that same spirit we saw in our mayor and our governor, who provided resolute leadership in the face of great anxiety. It is that same spirit we saw in Officer Richard Donahue, who rushed to Watertown when trouble struck and who remains hospitalized. It is that same spirit we saw in a city locked down by the terror of a few, but lifted up by the courage of many. And it is that same spirit we see here today in the thousands of men and women of law enforcement from all across the country who have come to mourn, who have come to honor, who have come to celebrate one of their finest. We are strong. We are Collier strong. We are Boston strong. But the true source of our strength and our resilience is our spirit, our recognition that we are united, we are connected, we are one. And when we serve each other, we give of ourselves, we grow in strength. The spirit of service shone brightly in Sean. We will miss you, Sean, but we will not forget you. It is now my honor to introduce another man who has lived his life with spirit and who has always understood that service to each other makes our communities and our countries stronger. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States.
You just heard Elizabeth Warren live at the Memorial for Sean Collier in Cambridge. On a blue sky, sunny day, here comes the Vice President, Joe Biden, on Boston Public Radio.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you. I'm standing for you. You should not be standing for me. All of you. All of you officers. Elizabeth, that was beautiful and accurate. And Senator Cowan, members and my friends in the congressional delegation from Massachusetts, Mr. President, Chief, that was a remarkable tribute to one of your own. Thank you for doing this, Mr. President. And I'm humbled that I was asked to participate. And I mean that seriously. We use that phrase lightly. Because I know from experience that there's not much that I'm going to be able to do to fill that void, that sense of loss, the grief, or answer those nagging questions. But why? Duvall, Governor, you not only made your state proud, you made the nation proud. You made all of America proud. Your resolute calmness, conviction, and determination resonated around the world because the whole world was watching. And a guy that I've known and loved for a long time, Mayor Menino, well, I call Tommy, one of the greatest mayors of all the mayors in this country. He kind of is, to me, the definition of Boston strong. Unyielding, absolutely committed, and literally getting himself out of bed when he should be in bed. To see to it that everything ran well. I convey my thanks to Commissioner Davis and the Cambridge Police Force, the Watertown Police Force, the MIT Police Force. You all did incredible work. And Mom, and Dad, and Joe, my heart goes out to you. I hope you find some solace in this moment of extreme grief, and looking around this field and listening to what is being said and written, the response of the people of this country and around the world about your son. No child should predecease their parents. And although every loss is different, one thing is certain, I know from experience. That sense of dread, that reliving the moment in the last 9 days, almost hourly, of the moment you learned the fate of your child. That sense of hollowness, it feels like you're being sucked into a void that you can't control. I remember. As I said, I know there's nothing anyone can say or do to bring you solace, but I also know from experience, as I said to you in the tent, that the moment will come when that thing that triggers the memory of Sean, that moment, whether it's a song or a season or a holiday or passing a little league field or whatever it is, you'll know it's going to be okay when the first instinct is you get a smile to your lips before you get a tear to your eyes. It's impossible to fathom that that will occur, but I promise you, I guarantee you, it will. You are an incredible family. I watched brothers and sisters on the Today Show on Monday. You gave me hope and you brought me and millions of others to tears. But you painted a vivid picture of your brother so everyone could understand. What stuck with me the most, and the probably hundreds of stories that have been told and written about since Sean's death, was when you were, I believe it was at a restaurant at Papa Gino's, and he turned to you, Mom, and said, there's a lady crying over there. You're a nurse. Go talk to her. Go talk to her. From what I've learned since then, that's who he has been his whole life. That's why he did what he did with the students here on campus. That's why, of all the things I've read, not knowing Sean, the one that struck home the most to me, Mr. President, was a student who was quoted as saying, he loved us, and we loved him. It's not a surprise, James, that they may have loved him, but to love him because they knew he loved them. What a remarkable son. What a remarkable brother. I've known the Colliers my whole life, and today's the first time I met them. I grew up in the same neighborhood. I was telling them that, like a lot of you, have a badge, a shield pinned on. In my neighborhood, when I moved to Claymont, you either became a firefighter, a cop, a priest, or you joined the trades. I wasn't capable of doing any of them, so I ended up where I am. But I know you. I know you. You have been... You're among the men and women I most admire. I have worked with you my entire career as a lawyer and serving as a senator for 36 years and now. In my view, what people don't understand sometimes about all of you is that every one of you, in spite of what the chief said, joined the force became a law enforcement officer for the same underlying reason. You felt a sense of obligation. You thought you could help. You all have that sort of inexplicable sense of duty and that gross underestimation of your value and how important you are. That's the single element, I think, that runs through all of American law enforcement. When events like this occur, the nation is always reminded of your bravery. But unfortunately, having attended so many funerals and memorial services for law enforcement officers of my career, I not only think of your bravery, but the first thoughts I have is your families. Because every day when you get up and pin on that shield and walk out that door, your husband, your wife, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, they know it's nagging that anything could happen. Yet they stand with you. They support you. And they have the courage to encourage you to do what you do. So I want to thank not only Sean's family for their willingness to support their brother, their son, taking on this work, but all of your husbands and wives, fathers and mothers and children. We owe you so much more than just honoring you on days of grief and celebration. There's a line from the English poet Keats. He said, "They also serve who only stand and wait." Your families, they stand and wait with the knowledge that anything can happen. They live with it every day. You never know when you get that call to walk up that three-story walk-up to break up a domestic fight or pull someone over in a routine traffic stop or sitting, standing, watch on a campus one of the most prestigious universities in the world. You're a different breed. And so are your families. I salute, I admire what you do on behalf of all of us every day. Thank you for standing in line between our families in danger every single solitary day. You know, I get asked, like my colleagues, almost every day since 9/11, why? Why? Why this terrorist phenomenon of the beginning of the 21st century? Why? People say to me, "For they surely know they can never defeat us. They can never overthrow us. They can never occupy us. So why? Why, whether it's Al-Qaeda central out of the Fatah or two twisted, perverted, cowardly knockoff jihadis here in Boston, why do they do what they do?" I've thought about it a lot because I deal with it a lot. And I've come to the conclusion, which is not unique to me, but they do it to instill fear, to have us, in the name of our safety and security, jettison what we value most and the world most values about us, our open society, our system of justice that guarantees freedom, the access of all Americans to opportunity, the free flow of information and people across this country, our transparency. That's
their target. It infuriates them that we refuse to bend, refuse to change, refuse to yield to fear. The doctrine of hate and oppression, they've found out, cannot compete the values of openness and inclusiveness. And that's why they're losing around the world. The irony is, we read about these events, we experience them. But the truth is, on every frontier, terrorism as a weapon is losing. It is not gaining adherence. And what galls them the most is America does remain that shining city on the hill. We're a symbol of the hopes and dreams of the very aspirations of people all around the world, people who live where they thrive. Our very existence makes a lie of their perverted ideology. So the only way they can gain ground is to instill fear that causes us to jettison our values, our way of life, for us to change. The moment we change, the moment we look inward, the moment we get in a crouch and are defensive, that's the moment when they win. What makes me so proud of this great state and the city of Boston and Cambridge and all those involved and the students on this campus, what makes me so proud to be an American is that we have not yielded to our fears. We have not compromised our values. We have not weakened our constitutional guarantees. We have not closed our borders. Just look around this field at the student body here. Just listen to the accents of the president and the vice president. This is a diverse campus. Probably the greatest technological university in the world. It's black, it's white, it's Muslim, it's Christian, it's Jewish, it's Hindu. That's who we are. You represent every community in the world. And what do? You challenge orthodoxy as they try to impose it. You push the envelope. You know that no change can come without jettisoning part of the past. You're in the cutting edge of science and technology. You make no distinction between the competence of male and female. You are their worst nightmare. All the things these perverted jihadis, self-made or organized, all the things they fear. And to the students that are here, I promise you, these events since 9/11 will not write the history of this century or this nation. They will be a mere chapter in the journey of the history of this country, because we will not change and they will not marginalize us. They will eventually be marginalized. What the world saw was 264 people injured. Three beautiful, decent people lost in the marathon. An 8-year-old boy, a Chinese student, a 29-year-old woman. And the world saw, they saw all who were there to celebrate, who were hurt, injured, and damaged.
And then they saw, 2 days later, this wonderful kid, and he's a kid, 26 years old, lose his life. That's part of what they saw. What they also saw, the incredible heroism, commitment, and resilience of the people of Boston, the people of Cambridge, of the American people. Oh, we have suffered. We are grieving, but we are not bending. We will not yield to fear. We will not hunker down. We will not be intimidated. When the World Trade Towers were taken down on that horrible day, the cynics said, we will never build another one. We built one taller. An absolute defiance. When bin Laden struck, there were those who said, we'll never follow him. We said we will follow him to the gates of hell if necessary. And we did. If the purpose of terrorism is to instill fear, you saw none of it here in Boston. Boston, you sent a powerful message to the world. What also they saw was people running to the site of the explosion. As I watched it, I had the same view of everyone else in the country. Why were those people finishing the marathon in a sprint? Why? To head to the hospital, some to operate, most to give blood. There wasn't a second thought. It wasn't like, let's sit around and think what we can do. It was instinctive. It's what you, figuratively speaking, all did when you raced toward the carnage instead of running away from it. What you did when you looked up to help your friends and neighbors and complete strangers in the middle of chaos. And let me tell you this, even though I am not a Bostonian, I am absolutely certain that next year's Boston Marathon will be bigger, more spectacular, and attended by more people than any marathon in the history of the United States of America. Because that's who you are. And that's the message. That's the message that is heard in every corner and cave. Those craven, misguided, perverted apostles of a decent and honorable faith are hiding. Boston will never yield. America will never yield. One of my favorite poets is Seamus Heaney. Now, I know the congressman thinks I always quote them Irish poets because I'm Irish. That's not the reason I do it. I quote Irish poets because they're the best poets. That's the reason why. And the Collier family knows that, right? But all kidding aside, he wrote a poem called The Curate Troy. And he there's a stanza in that poem that I think best defines the nature of the American spirit, whether you are a newly minted citizen or your family's been here for eight generations. And the stanza goes like this. He said, history says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. I think that sentiment is stamped into the DNA of Americans, regardless of where they come from. Ladies and gentlemen, It's who we are. It's who we are. It's who we've always been. Just look at the journey of the history of this country. For us Americans, we believe that hope and history can rhyme. That's what separates us. The most compelling line in the famous documents that have been written, the Constitution and the Declaration, the one that sticks out to me the most, to form a more perfect union. The moment we stop is the moment we lose. So my message is, embrace the memories of those beautiful people we lost in the bombing. Stand by and help and support the hundreds who were injured. And honor this hero, Sean, for what he was. Remember him not merely for the sacrifice he made, but for the man he was. We Irish have an expression, the highest praise you can give in my family, in my neighborhood, a man or a woman, is to look at them and say, he was a good man. This was a good man. The family, my prayer is that God will bring you peace and healing. And may God bless all of you. And most of all, may God protect all of you first responders as you protect us. God bless you all.
That was Joe Biden, Vice President of the United States, preceded by Elizabeth Warren. He was speaking beneath this huge American flag, suspended between two cranes about 6 feet away where he was from the casket of the young police officer, Sean Collier. He was speaking to thousands, Marjorie, thousands and thousands of people, many of them wearing these badges that said Collier Strong. One of the things that was really moving, you could tell that it moved Biden as well. He said what many of us have said, but not with this level of painful experience. No child should predecease a parent. And I wonder if everybody in that audience know that he lost both a wife and a daughter when he was a young man, just after he was elected senator decades ago.
And so his obviously son was severely injured.
That's right. So in any case, that was Joe Biden. You heard it live from the MIT campus, where, again, thousands and thousands and thousands of police officers, student faculty, and, of course, family of Sean Collier were in attendance.
When we come back, we're going to be joined by a trauma surgeon from the Brigham and Women's Hospital who was there when the victims of the marathon came into the emergency room. We're going to take your calls. And later on, we're going to be joined by State Treasurer Steve Grossman, who's going to tell us about the costs of this tragedy to the businesses, to the first responders, and who's going to foot the bill. Stay tuned for that on Boston Public Radio.
True story, June 2001. A 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton.
Hello, I'm Laura Buxton.
Let's go of a balloon.
Phew!
That balloon floats 140 miles and lands in the yard of an entirely different girl named Laura Buxton.
They're both Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
No.
Yes. Maybe we were meant to meet.
Is our world full of magic and meaning?
Strange things do happen by chance.
Or is it just chance? That's next time on Radiolab.
Tomorrow night at 10.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the 17th Annual Nantucket Wine Festival, May 15th through the 19th. Proud to partner with WGBH for this collection of over 50 events on the island with winemakers, chefs, and wine and food enthusiasts. NantucketWineFestival.com. And White Oak Cottages at Fox Hill Village in Westwood, providing assisted living care for those with Alzheimer's and dementia in a family home environment with 12 private bedrooms. WhiteOakCottages.com.
Hip-hop's current obsessions, according to rapper Talib Kweli?
We're in our rock and roll phase, you know, sex, drugs, and party, 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 party.
But Kweli says don't be fooled by what you hear in the mainstream.
Hip-hop is preoccupied with life. You can find a hip-hop song dealing with any subject matter.
The State of Hip-Hop with Talib Kweli, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on WGBH Radio.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success. So read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And Nova, come face-to-face with the reptilian rulers of prehistoric Australia, some of the largest and most dangerous to have ever walked the Earth. Australia's first 4 billion years continues Wednesday at 9 on WGBH 2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're joined on the phone by a trauma surgeon at Brigham and Women's. Her 3-year-old daughter was near the finish line a week ago Monday. Joining us on the phone is Dr. Zara Cooper. Dr. Cooper, thanks so much for your time.
Yes, good afternoon.
So, Doctor, tell us, Jim just mentioned your 3-year-old daughter was not far from the finish line, but you were in the hospital. So what happened when you heard about the bombing?
Right. It was sheer panic. I knew that she had been down at the Boston Common and she had been watching the runners with her nanny earlier in the afternoon. And at that moment, when I heard about the explosion, my first instinct was to run to the emergency room. And as I opened the door to my office, I thought, oh, my goodness, where is my daughter? So as I was running to the emergency room, I was desperately trying to text my nanny and get in touch with her. And coincidentally, my husband had just taken off on a plane at the same time. So it was panic stricken in multiple levels. But, I got to the emergency room and managed to do what a lot of working moms do, which is multitask quickly.
Wait a second, Dr. Cooper, did you have to participate in surgery before you knew if your kid was okay near the
finish? I did not. I was very fortunate. Yeah, I was very fortunate that my nanny was able to get in touch with me pretty quickly. And within 15 minutes, I knew that they were okay and they were actually on their way home.
Great.
But Dr. Cooper, a lot of the victims did come to the emergency room at the Brigham. What was it like in there? It must have been a little bit of a very, very wild scene.
Right. Yeah, it was very intense. I mean, I think that, we were all really struck by the magnitude of the injuries that were coming in, but also just the uncertainty and the unknown. We were getting EMS reports, and it was unclear whether or not there were more bombs. You may recall that there was a report of a bomb at JFK.
Yes.
At the JFK Library.
Library, yeah.
We didn't know if there would be more casualties coming in. So there was a lot of uncertainty, and we were trying to stay ahead to make sure that we were prepared to take anything that came in. There was a lot of activity. I have to say that everybody pulled together so quickly. It was really remarkable. For my colleagues in acute medicine and acute care surgery, we live in the emergency department. But, I mean, there were people who were pathologists and cardiologists and people who aren't always in the emergency room who were there ready to lend a hand. So there were dozens of providers.
The other thing that was really remarkable
is that there were a lot of health, law enforcement officials there as well. So it was kind of odd to have, the FBI and the ATF and all those folks wandering around too.
My understanding is from one of our colleagues, Liz Alessi, there were 36 injured people brought to Brigham and Women's, and 9 are still hospitalized. Are those numbers right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
And one of the things I heard from one of your colleagues, I'm not sure if it was your hospital or elsewhere, on the radio this morning, mentioning that of the roughly 260 people who were brought in injured to this, assemblage of hospitals throughout in and around Boston, that none of them are going to die, which is obviously great news, even though some of the injuries are quite serious. If this had happened 5 years ago, would you all be able to make that statement, or is the technology and your skills advanced to such a degree how long ago would this not have been the case, I guess?
Right. So I think that there were a number of issues, another number of things that were conspiring actually in our favor that day. One was that, we have a lot of major trauma centers in Boston, which is unusual for a city of this size. So the finish line was within 5 or 10 minutes of multiple major trauma centers, which is really very fortunate for taking care of severely injured patients. It was also right across the street from the medical tent where, in Boston, we joke that every third person is either a doctor or a nurse. So a medical tent that is filled with overeducated healthcare providers who are ready, willing, and able to provide the most advanced technology right there on the scene. And then, I also have to say that Boston EMS deserves such tremendous credit for thinking quickly on their feet and just being so prepared for just this kind of event. So I think all of those things conspired. And then on top of that, one silver lining in the conflicts from the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq is that we have learned a lot about triage and about trauma resuscitation and about taking care of severely injured patients, managing wounds. And I think we've also learned more about rehabilitation along the way. So I think that these patients who are survivors of this terrible tragedy will benefit from things that we've learned in the past few years.
We're talking with Dr. Zara Cooper, who's a trauma surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. You know, I assume EMS was crucial because they were able to stop the bleeding, preventing more people from bleeding to death before they had a chance to get to the emergency room, right?
Right. They were crucial in that, but also they were so smart in their triage, and they were so clear. So patients were triaged even before they got to the emergency room. There were multiple levels of triage, and they were also smart. You know, I didn't know this on Monday, but in hindsight and what I've learned, they were also really smart about how they distributed the injured in a variety of different hospitals. So they didn't all come to the major trauma centers. I mean, no single institution was overwhelmed by the volume that they received. And again, I think EMS deserves a lot of credit for that. I know at our institution, no patient had to wait for an operating room. And, you know, I would doubt that that wasn't the case at other institutions as well.
And I heard, and I've read over and over, Dr. Cooper, people talking about some of the victims being in shock, and they seem to be very calm. What is shock physiologically? Is that the body's, is that the way for the mind to deal with these severe injuries, or what is that?
Right, right. That's an interesting question. So there's the psychological shock. And yes, I would agree. I think that one of the things that was most disturbing for me was seeing these patients come in and you know, their eyes were frozen and they looked completely glassed over and they just were in true shock. You know, and I've taken care of a lot of very severely injured patients and I haven't seen it to quite this degree before. You know, that being said, there's also physiologic shock, which means that your body isn't able to provide the oxygen that your organs need, or your organs aren't able to get the blood that they need. And it's usually associated with hemorrhage or with severe infection. And so in this case, we would be worried about hemorrhagic shock. But I think that what you're describing, Marjorie, is really the psychological shock and just, you know, the raw fear that these patients felt coming into the emergency room and just having no idea what was going on.
Are they in pain? I mean, they've lost limbs, but that was what seems incredible, that people weren't screaming. Maybe they were there, but that's what I wondered about the shock, if that prevents you, if that helps you cope with the pain.
Right. So in some cases it does. I can't really speak to what happened in individual cases, mostly because I didn't see them all. But in some cases that will happen. I mean, there was one gentleman that was described as being, you know, quickly tourniqueted by EMS so that he wasn't losing a lot of blood from his leg, even though his leg had been blown off. And when he came in, he was conversing with EMS and with the providers, you know, as if, understanding that something devastating had happened, but as if, you know, he was able to continue a conversation, and everybody was really stunned by that. And I think that is a sign of psychological shock. As far as the pain, I mean, we are really vigilant in trying to help manage the pain for these patients. I mean, unfortunately, many of them will need multiple operations, have already gone through multiple operations in dealing with their wounds and then dealing with the reconstruction. And so, you know, pain control is something that's really important to us, something that we're committed to their comfort and managing their symptoms. But yes, unfortunately, it's something that they can expect to experience, you know, as they progress.
We're talking to Zara Cooper. She's a trauma surgeon at Brigham and Women's. Dr. Cooper, let me preface my question by saying when I have blood taken, I feel faint. So this, I want to put this in context. What's the state? You're all professionals, and virtually every doctor with whom we've spoken since last Monday has been so stunningly impressive. But what's your state of mind when you encounter something? I don't mean individual injuries, but
right,
the volume of incredible injuries like that. Do you have time to think about how overwhelming and frightening it is? Or are you just so laser focused on what you have to do that those thoughts don't enter your head until you're done? What's that like for you?
Yeah, I have to say that there is sort of this weird zen
mm-hmm.
that you get into when you are very, very focused on just doing the right thing and taking care of your patient and applying your skill in trying to make the situation better. And it is easy at that moment to kind of block everything out and just say, what do I need to do next? And so certainly I think that for that night, we were all there and that's exactly what we were doing. And, you know, everybody that I worked with pulled together just with that laser focus on getting these patients to the operating operating room, getting them the operations that they needed, getting them the specialists that they needed, taking care of everything, and just making sure that they were okay.
One last question for me, Dr. Cooper. We're talking to Zara Cooper from the Brigham. We've read a lot, and I know you're a trauma surgeon, so maybe this isn't your area of expertise, but you are a physician. We've read a lot about people saying, and it's really uplifting, people that have lost a limb or even two limbs, I'm going to run the marathon next year, or a ballroom dancer who lost a limb saying she's going to start dancing again. If you are a healthy person and you've gone through this kind of trauma, in terms of time, what can you expect before you get the prosthetic devices working? And I mean, are we talking a year out, 2 years out, ballpark? Do you know?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously it varies. One thing that is working in the favor of most of these patients is that they are relatively young and healthy, you know, extraordinarily healthy, actually. And so what we look for in starting to apply a prosthetic is for the swelling to go down. So once a limb has been amputated, there's swelling and healing that needs to go down after the surgery itself. And that can take somewhere around 8 weeks or so. So we can anticipate that over the next few months, they'll start getting fitted for their prosthetics. You know, many of them will have good upper body strength already, and often for patients who are amputees, that's the struggle, is trying to readjust, you know, the way that they carry their weight. So for those patients who have good upper body strength, they, you know, will have a faster recovery. And I don't think that it's impossible to think that some of them will be running in next year's marathon.
Boy, is
that
great.
Hey, Zara,
Dr. Zara Cooper, trauma surgeon from Brigham and Women's. We're glad your kid is okay, and thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, really nice to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too. How encouraging is that within a year,
I know, it's
people
it's
could
staggering.
Be running?
You know, by the way, our colleague Liz Alessi, a reporter at Boston Public Radio, made a round of calls to hospitals. There are about 50 marathon victims still hospitalized, And again, as I said, a doctor, a trauma surgeon today mentioned that none of those who are hospitalized, every single one they expect to live, which is just terrific news.
Coming up next, we're going to be joined by the Treasurer of Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Steve Grossman. He's going to tell us about the cost of all this, the financial hit the state is taking in the aftermath of last week's bombing. Stay tuned to that conversation on Boston Public Radio.
Hector Ruiz grew up in a small border town in Mexico where he used to shine shoes to help his parents make ends meet. But he grew up to become one of the biggest names in the world of technology. Now the former Fortune 500 CEO joins us to pass on some wisdom and his take on one of the biggest lawsuits his industry ever faced. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Ellis Insurance, offering personal and business insurance, financial planning, and their online insurance tune-up, identifying relevant risk management solutions for families and businesses. Exceptional service, intelligent insurance. EllisInsurance.com. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, with more than 30 years of experience and 15 locations throughout New England, New York, and Washington, D.C., offering local, long-distance, and international moving services. GentleGiant.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're wondering what happened to Brian McGrory, the editor of the Boston Globe, obviously the vice president of the United States, went rather long. So we will not speak to Brian today. We hope to reschedule him for tomorrow. And at worst, we will talk to him again next Wednesday. The last time we talked to this next person was immediately after the interfaith service in the South End, which he attended. He's the treasurer of the Commonwealth. Steve Grossman, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back, Jim, Marjorie.
Thank you for being with us, Steve. You know, you mentioned when you were here last week that your 8-year-old grandchild was by the finish line, uninjured, but by the finish line. But emotionally, how's your grandchild doing?
I think he's doing fine. He had his 8th birthday on Monday, and there was sort of a follow-up conversation to one of the ones I related to you when he was watching a Red Sox game with my son, his father, and I think my son had his arm around Will, and Will looked it up at one point and says, "Daddy, that little boy is never going to be able to watch a Red Sox game." And he started to cry. And so it's really, I think there's an emotional cost here that we have yet to fully understand. I think those of us who grieve with the people of New York after 9/11, we felt great empathy and great connection to the people of New York with the great loss of life. But when it's right on your own doorstep, you realize just how emotionally damaging this has all been, besides the physical damage and the cost in financial terms, which is obviously the easiest part of it to fix, although not always so easy for those businesses and those people who have suffered significant loss. But I am struck when the physician just was talking about running in next year's marathon. I got an email from somebody I hadn't talked to in years, and one of his very good friends lost a leg, and he said, would you have any way to know whether or not next spring she might be able to throw out a pitch at Fenway Park? Because that's the one thing which she is thinking about, lying in that hospital bed. Could I ever get a chance to go out onto the mound and throw out a first pitch? And my guess is the Red Sox are going to give an awful lot of people whose lives were forever changed an opportunity to throw out that first pitch and to have some emotional sustenance while they're in recovery, which is part of what recovery is all about, emotional and physical.
Steve, I'm sure you heard, we're talking to the treasurer of the Commonwealth, Steve Grossman. I assume you heard or read about Ken Feinberg, who obviously has built a reputation after his years of working for Ted Kennedy, is the man in charge of lots of these huge funds. He did the 9/11 fund. He was picked by the mayor and I assume the governor to administer the One Fund Boston. They raised $20 million in a week, and we know that's going to go to the victims in whatever fashion, and he explained in great detail the mechanics. What we've been talking about the last few days, and I'm sure you're thinking about too, are all the other costs. Whether it's additional police costs borne by places like Boston, Watertown, Cambridge, the cost, you work closely as treasurer, I know, with tons of small businesses and do trainings. I think you have one coming up we'll mention before you go. Are you, as the governor, is the legislature looking at how, one, the costs that have already been, the government costs that were additional are going to be met, and two, is there any role for government in dealing with employees that didn't go paid for a week, for businesses that were shut down that lost, in some cases, tens of thousands of dollars? Are you involved in any of that conversation?
Well, it's hard to know because it's so early in the process. I mean, we know that the president, by doing an emergency declaration last week, then precipitated FEMA's involvement in all of this. But it's very hard to know precisely what that will actually cover. I mean, I remember when the tornado hit Springfield not quite 2 years ago. FEMA was involved, and the efforts on FEMA's part essentially are that FEMA will provide 75% federal funding for emergency protective measures, including direct federal assistance. But it's very hard to know precisely what that means. I mean, we're talking about efforts that the federal government is obliged to undertake to provide assistance for emergency measures for those that are authorized under certain acts of government to save lives, to protect property, public health, public safety, lessen or avert the threat of a catastrophe. And that's all direct federal assistance. But it will be months before I think anybody will know precisely what parts of this FEMA will pay for, what they won't pay for. I mean, we're obviously thinking about all those merchants and all those workers who lost because they had hourly wages and they didn't get to work. Some businesses have insurance, some don't. I think the mayor of the city has done a fabulous job creating the Marathon Business Resource Center to put the City Hall to go out there on Boylston Street, to call for photographers to come out and help document damages for insurance claims. I understand that as of this morning, more than 200 photographers had signed up voluntarily to take pictures to help these merchants. But obviously, some insurance policies do cover disasters like this, and some don't. And I think it'll be a long time before we can figure all that out. But there's no doubt that we will seek, as a state, I think this is the governor and his emergency team more than me as treasurer, but they will seek maximum amount of FEMA funding, 75% federal funding, to cover whatever we can make the case is a natural loss of life, loss of all the things that we lost those days, and we needed help to get ourselves back on track.
You know, Steve, we're talking to Steve Grossman, treasurer of Massachusetts. I've known you for a long time, and I know you're one of the people in government who actually believes in the good things that government does, unlike a lot of others who trash it. We learned earlier today, we talked to Bill Keating, for example, at 12 o'clock, who obviously serves, the congressman serves in the Homeland Security Committee, talked about, we hope Congress, and I'm paraphrasing what he says, takes seriously the financial needs of training and equipping first responders in the wake of what happened here. Hours ago, we read that the residents of Newtown, Connecticut, rejected a budget which included a little short of $1 million extra for school security. So without disparaging the residents there, because one of the select people who reflected on the vote said, you know, we've lost our sense of confidence here. That's why it went down. Do people get it? I mean, do people get that this police presence that was mostly overwhelmingly praised cost a lot of money that wasn't accounted for, that having extra security at the marathon next year is not just going to be borne by the Boston Athletic Association? Do real people get that, or have you guys not done a good enough job of convincing people that, that they got a belly up to the bar?
You know, without knowing specifically what they have in mind, I have talked to legislators in the past few days, and there's definitely a desire to do something to step in and to help. I mean, some people think we may take a significant tourism hit. How do you deal with that? Well, we have agencies within government that deal with tourism, and it may very well be that some of the leaders within state government, I hear a very positive feeling about doing that, we'll step in and we'll create a special fund. I mean, look, if we can put money aside for emergencies that have taken place, this is, to me, a defining moment in the history of this Commonwealth, going back, whether you go back to Paul Revere's ride 238 years ago or any period of time, this is a defining moment. It seems to me that when citizens come together, when leaders come together, the governor, I thought, did a superb job, the mayor did a superb job, Ed Davis and the entire team, the first responders. But at some point, a society is judged by how it spends its precious financial resources. And if we are the kind of society and state that we know we are, then we will make available resources to help in whatever way we can, consistent with what public funds should be used for. So I'm an optimist about that, and I think you will see federal and state resources, taxpayers' resources, and I don't know too many citizens of this Commonwealth who would object to doing that. There will always be some who will object because that is not our role or we don't have the money. Yeah. I say, how can we not do that? Not how can we do it, but how can we not expend those resources?
We're talking with the Treasurer of the Commonwealth, Steve Grossman. You know, I hate to bring politics into this, but there has been a political dust-up, and I wanted to ask you, because you used to run the DNC, did you not?
Democratic National Committee.
Oh, yeah, I did. I was chairman
under Bill Clinton. Right.
Well, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is taking a little grief of Steve Grossman because she, at the DNC and its website, was saying people should send out gratitude to the Boston first responders, but in order to send out, to participate in sending out that gratitude, to sign your name, you not only had to sign your name, you had to provide your email and your zip code. And she's being criticized because this appears to be sort of a fundraising and volunteer database effort on the part of the DNC at the time of this tragedy. What do you make of that? Why do they need the zip codes and the emails if they would just want to send a thank you note?
Well, I think, look, good people can differ as to whether or not they should have collected the email addresses and the information. Probably in retrospect, had it been done absolutely without any data being collected, but simply as a act of grace on the part of people to send messages that they wanted to send, that might have avoided the criticism that was sent their way. And I saw some candidates have actually reflected on the fact that they might not have collected the data. You know, we live in a highly politicized, polarized environment. I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's a friend of mine, did something that she thought was right and decent and kind and loving. I understand why people are criticizing, because you can always use that, what's called data mining, to do fundraising or to do organizing,
right,
or whatever. So I understand that. And in retrospect, perhaps they should have avoided collecting the data and simply done it without any information being collected. But I think her motives were kind and generous, and I like to ascribe kind and generous motives to anybody, particularly at a time when, as the governor likes to say, we need to turn toward one another and not on one another.
I'm going to try kind and generous in the future, Steve. Hey, Steve, before we let you go, I thought of you this morning. I want to ask you about what surreal moments you've had in the last 9 days. I can say what town you live in, right? That's public, right?
Yeah, I live in Newton.
Which is one of the abutting communities. I live in Cambridge. This morning on the way in, every time there's a huge Powerball thing, it's $116 million today, I go buy a ticket for me and Marjorie and whatever. And as I'm in this store, and I'm thinking of you because I knew you were going to be on today, and obviously you're in charge of the lottery as being the treasurer. My surreal moment of the morning is I'm leaving, and I realized, without having thought, the place where I'm buying the lottery ticket in Central Square is the place where the younger brother went on the night that they went on to kill Sean Collier, allegedly, and then the firefight in Watertown. It's the very same 7-Eleven where this kid was buying snacks last Thursday night. What has this been for you, like for you personally? I mean, you've been to all these places. You've touched all. What's this been like for you as a human, not as a treasurer?
You know, I went to a lecture the other day over Tufts University. On the way out of the lecture, I bumped into a friend of mine who owns a real estate business. And I looked at him and I said, "How's Roseanne doing?" His colleague, his name is Roseanne Sedoya. She's a woman who has worked in for many years. I actually know her. We had occasion to do some business with her in the past when I was in business. And she lost at least one leg and severely damaged. She went to the Red Sox game and then down to the marathon. You know, I think the interesting thing is that because Boston, although we are a great, great city, is such a small town and a small community, and
exactly,
we are all so interwoven and interrelated, I don't know anybody who doesn't know somebody who, in one way or another, my colleague here in my office who works with me in communications, went through a program for political grassroots organizing for women called Emerge. And one of her colleagues was a young lady named Jen Lemmerman, I believe. And she's the sister of Sean Collier. And I heard her speak yesterday in the church over in Stoneham when I attended the funeral service. Nobody doesn't know somebody, and in that sense, we are so bound together emotionally, physically, spiritually, in a way that will always... There are certain dates in your life and in my life. I mean, I'm in my mid-60s, late 60s, 67 years old, and I remember where I was. John Kennedy was assassinated.
Sure.
We all remember where we are at certain dates. No Bostonian who's old enough to remember will not remember where they were on the marathon on that day, and they won't remember fondly those friends whose lives were forever changed, because everybody knows somebody, and that is what makes us such a family of citizens, and that's what binds us together. And, you know, when Joe Biden, and I'll end on this note because I know you got to go, when Joe Biden ended his remarks with that wonderful poem from Seamus Heaney, when he talked about, "History says don't hope on this side of the grave, and our job is to make hope and history rhyme." Well, let me tell you, the end of that poem reads as follows. It says, "So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Call the miracle self-healing, the utter self-revealing, double take of feeling. If there's fire on the mountain or lightning and storm and a God speaks from the sky, that means someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its term." I'm going to continue to make optimism a way of life. We here in Massachusetts are going to do that. We showed our best. We continue to show our best. And you and Marjorie have done a wonderful job at bringing us all together emotionally and spiritually during these last few days. And we thank you for it.
And Steve, and by the way, since you're a good Irishman, that's why you love those Irish poets, right, Steve Grossman?
You got it.
Steve Grossman, treasurer of the Commonwealth. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks,
Steve,
Jim. Thanks
so
Marjorie. Thanks
thank
for having
you very
me.
Much for joining us. And thank you for that beautiful recitation.
It was great.
Seamus Heaney. That was
you
wonderful.
Know, just at the moment that Steve Grossman was saying to us, you know, we're all a family, or what he said at the end, Marjorie and I are listening to Steve and watching people as they leave the memorial at MIT. And tell tell people, Marjorie, what happened as the police officers,
well,
thousands of them are leaving the scene.
The audience, the police officers were filing out in their navy blue uniforms, and the audience stood and gave them a standing ovation. And they were clapping.
It was beautiful. And the scene there, for those who didn't see it or hear Joe Biden or hear Elizabeth Warren, who spoke, which we broadcast here live. It's this unbelievably beautiful 60-some degree sunny day in Cambridge. There was this huge American flag, one of the biggest I've ever seen. Actually, you know where the biggest, where you spend your time on the Cape on exit
Burger
6
King.
Is one of the biggest. But this was close. This huge American flag, beautifully suspended between two cranes.
Was it cranes or fire trucks?
I think they were cranes. And by the way, if you live or drive through Cambridge, essentially what Cambridge is, in addition to the wonderful place that it is on virtually every street with, I guess, the exception of one last week, they're cranes absolutely everywhere. And I think they were cranes. It was a beautiful use. Biden gives this speech that was quite touching, and you had thousands of people paying tribute to Sean Collier, 27-year-old man who was killed. And by the way, we asked people earlier in the day, and we're going to do this again tomorrow and probably the next day, what are the questions that you have that are unanswered that matter to you a lot, that we're all searching for? One of the questions I've had, which I don't think most people know that there's been at least a tentative answer to, why did they kill Collier, assuming they did? And at least according to CBS News, John Miller, who was the reporter on this case, what he is saying, authorities are saying, is they killed him, the brothers, because they only had one gun and they felt they needed another weapon. And so apparently, again, this is CBS News reporting, the reason they took this 27-year-old man's life was so that they'd have an additional weapon in the hope that they could take other people's lives. It is really foul. And the other weird thing, do you remember this? We hadn't mentioned this in a few days. Talk about what you call 6 degrees of separation. Then Grossman just talked about all the people he knows in his office, this sort of thing. You remember that Sean Collier and Richard Donahue Jr.
were in training together. Police Academy together.
Donahue is the MBTA officer who followed these brothers into Watertown and was injured and apparently is in serious condition. But it is true what Grossman said. All of us have said this. The connections that are made every single minute of every day, it is just unbelievable.
But you know what was a really hopeful note for me to end on today is that we talked to Zara Cooper. She's a trauma surgeon at the Brigham. I thought people were being wildly optimistic when they talked about having lost a leg and they're going to run the marathon next year, or they're going to be, as this woman told the Herald today, she's going to be on Dancing with the Stars, the ballroom dancer who lost her leg.
The woman that Peter Galsinis wrote the column about on the front page of the day. It was a great column.
I thought that was sort of cockeyed optimism, and she said, no, you're young and healthy. The swelling obviously has to go down, but prosthetics being what they are in 2013, it is certainly not out of the realm of possibility that if you're young and healthy today, having lost a leg in April of 2013, that come April of 2014, you can run 26 miles. I mean, how impressive and encouraging.
Can you imagine what next year is going to be? I mean, assuming that even half the people live up to their commitment to run, to view, to be there.
You know what time it is, Jim?
Marathon.
You know what time it is?
What is it?
It's time for you to start training for
a
marathon.
I think it's long past time. I ran my two. I'll be there observing and cheering and that sort of thing. Incidentally, tomorrow, I don't know if we're going to take a break from marathon. We'll obviously bring you the latest. Next Tuesday is the primary in a very important Senate race that obviously has been backburnered because of what happened a week ago Monday. We have invited all five of the candidates on the Republican Democratic side to join us. Four of the five have said yes. They'll be with us tomorrow. We're still waiting for Ed Markey. He'd be the fifth. So that's tomorrow. All four of the five Senate candidates, we hope 5 out of 5, plus marathon updates. Thanks so much for listening today. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
We'll see you tomorrow at noon.